Welcome, welcome everyone to Masterclass tonight, October 5th, 2023. So glad to have you guys.
If you don't steal, let me know. Or I'm
hot mic. Hot mic. On the phone. Let's see. We have definitely a good list of presentations tonight and presenters. Of all different topics, not staying within one field of IT, but a lot of different stuff, maybe even a little business-like. So this should be a lot of fun. Get ready to go. We're going to keep it at 15 minutes each, hopefully. They may have to talk a little fast to get it going, but they'll work with us. We may end up changing this to 8 o'clock next week, starting next week. Although we do have a starting term next week as well. So, I mean, an ending term next week as well. So we'll have to get this through and have the execs okay it. So once we get that vote through, we'll go ahead and do that. But we will definitely let you know as we move forward. For now, we're starting at 9 o'clock. Let's get started, though, with our first presenter. Jose, are you ready?
Hey, I have a night operation, and I submitted my presentation in the file folder, and also let my team lead know.
Ah, okay. So that means I got to pull it up. That's what I was wondering. So let me go into... Oops. I'm getting there. Patients, Masterclass. All right. Can everybody see the screen? Great.
Hello, everybody. I want to welcome y'all to my presentation, Leadership in the IT Field, by me, Jose Alvarez. What is leadership? So this picture of me and my team when I was in Korea. Most recently, this was the first group of soldiers I really led because I was a one-man team for most of the time as a JNN operator. And then I moved to Korea and became an SNN operator and got to experience leading these group of guys. They were all fantastic, knew their job. So what is leadership? Leadership, in my own words, is being able to show your subordinates how to complete work and be there in any given situation, being open to any suggestions, but always choosing the best one for the team. By the book definition is leaders motivate and achieve something new and better and taking risk challenges and challenging the status quo. The importance of IT leadership in a digital age. IT leaders are responsible for fostering a culture of innovation, identifying emerging technologies that can give organizations a competitive edge, and facilitating the rapid adoption of new tools and processes. IT leaders are also responsible for developing and maintaining robust business continuity and disaster recovery plans to ensure that the organization can continue to operate in the face of disruptions or crises. So when it comes to getting new technologies, as I said before, I worked on a JNN, a joint node network system. Then I moved to a SNN, a small node network system. Basically combining the job of a Sierra, which is a satellite guy, and a November, which is a network guy, which is myself, to accomplish supporting users in a field environment. And that is something I had to learn to adapt to on the fly. I had basically maybe a month and a half to learn the equipment. And then right after that, I was on missions back to back. I went on probably, I say about 6 or 7 missions in my year in Korea, while also doing 2 classes at a time the whole time while I was there. This slide right here talks about understanding the technical side and having leadership capabilities. Being able to walk through your team in any troubleshooting task will instill trust in your team and your company or organization. Understanding the pieces of equipment you work with, such as routers, switches, and virtual machines, enables you to teach those who aren't familiar. So right here, me and my soldier, Yun, he's showing me the spectrum analyzer that's hooked up to the Phoenix. The spectrum analyzer basically just peaks where the satellite's at. You can see if you get close to it, you can adjust the dish and just peak the signal to get the strongest signal you can get. So he actually taught me a lot on this piece of equipment. So it's just not me being the leader, but having my soldiers show me how to use this equipment so I can be the best leader I can for them. Challenges in leadership. Some challenges that may come up are having subordinates who have a problem taking orders or being told how to do something. There's only been a handful of times where I've had to really hammer down on somebody about, you know, showing up on time, listening when class is being taught on the pieces of equipment, because we had 3 different pieces of equipment that we had to learn, and we tabled. Table is basically a setup and teardown drill. You set up, get on the bird, make sure you're passing data, and then tear down right after that. We would do that maybe like 2 times out the year. I've done it at my old unit at Bragg a handful of times. But it's just keeping your subordinates informed, ready to go, so they know what they're doing, and they fail at no task because they know what they're doing. Technology is constantly changing as time goes on. In the last 2 decades, we have seen major updates when it comes to technology. Adjusting to different situations to have a proper training on the equipment before deploying it, it would help network engineers and other supporting individuals work more proficiently, which ties into always informing whoever you're working with. It could be even peers or someone above that they're just not tracking what's going on. Another challenge is remote working. Could pose a challenge. Ensuring your team is staying on task, completing their work. This will challenge the integrity of yourself as well as the ones appointed under you. So we all went through the COVID session, and when I was at my last unit at Bragg, we had to do remote work. Not much was going on. Basically, you just check in, but you got to make sure you're still doing your PT. Any progressive stuff you need to do, you need to be doing it. Skillport, all that stuff. So, leading IT projects. So, first step, project initiation. State the project's objective, its scale, and expected outcome. So, this is the point where the only way I know it is military style. So you have your LT and your platoon sergeant, They have a mission to get brought down from the captain to all the higher-ups. You get your con up, you get explained how many users you're going to be supporting, what equipment is going to be used, our redundancy, our backup plans, and what team will we go out there with. So, and then the next step is the site survey. I've done this before with my LT. Basically, you just drive out. I'm assuming if you do it in an office type situation, you would go to the office that you're going to be installing the network equipment, access points, Cat5s, router switches, firewalls, and all that. You would take down the information, see where you're going to place everything. When I did it, it was, we're going to see where we're going to put our satellite dish, where we're going to point it at, using the compass and all that. So site survey, while doing the site survey, you will most likely meet with the stakeholders and communicate what services they need, how many users there will be needed to be supported in that building, and how many access points, and what type of security they would want in place. Leading IT projects continue. Team building. Having a cohesive team that covers each field from routing, cybersecurity, SATCOM, cable management, and others, and make sure everyone knows the task they need to be, that needs to be accomplished. So there's been times where I've had soldiers that didn't know what was going on and how to provide, how to hook up the equipment and do these services. But that's why we have this whole month of COMEXs, just communication exercises, to train them up and get ready for maybe their first mission or setting up just the equipment. So practice, practice, practice is a big thing for you, your team to be efficient and understand what's going on. So execution. As a leader, you will bounce around helping those who need it. You are there to ensure the job's getting done in a timely manner. Ensure that jobs are being done to standard and communicate with stakeholders how work is going on and any issues coming up. So from this, I've worked with a 3-star general before, and you would have to communicate, hey, this is how the network's looking. If we're having any latency issues, SATCOM problems, configuration issues, you also have your warrant officers there to help you out, which would be your basically higher up network engineers in the civilian world. So you would just try to handle everything, you know, the lowest level is where I go into problem solving. Also, just communicate with your platoon sergeants, your LTs, so they can communicate with the higher ups or your boss, whoever your team lead is on that business situation. So problem solving, when it comes to solving issues such as misconfigurations, it should be handled at the lowest level, as I said, then move up once you exhaust your resources. So reach out to your teammates, crew members. They all have valuable knowledge. One person could be specialized in just IPs, network configurations. Other guy could be expert in firewalls, setting up access points, and so on and so forth. So post-implementation, or AAR. If you don't know what AAR is, it's Army language for after action review. So gather feedback from end users and stakeholders to identify areas for improvement. So after every mission, every business venture you go on in the civilian world, you document anything you, any issues you run into, whether it be, like I said, configurations, pieces of equipment not talking to each other, outer switches, firewalls, any problems you run into, basically, document it, save it on a flash drive, put it somewhere where you know it's secure, where you can have even a team folder that holds all the issues you run into. So in the future, when you do see that issue again, you know the fix right away because you have it right there in the folder, right there on the flash drive. The flash drive is kind of hard to keep up with unless you're really organized, but the way we work, it'll get lost within the first 2 weeks. So document it, go over it with the team, say, hey, this is what we can do better. This is what we're going to practice on. Just so you can be, as I said, proficient and efficient for the next time you go out and do your job. And finally, in conclusion, leading IT projects can be complex, but with careful planning, effective communication, strong leadership, and focus on delivering value to the organization, IT leaders can increase the likelihood of project success. Additionally, ongoing learning and the application of best practices can help improve your ability to lead IT projects effectively. And here are my references. That's me right there with the Phoenix, striking a pose. We all was doing some learning how to get a little photo in, you know, to make it look good and show my company. But yeah, that's it. I hope you enjoyed my presentation. So I wasn't able to be here. Had a night operation I had to do. But I hope you all enjoyed it. Thanks.
Excellent job, Jose. Great job. You can hear me, but that was great. Very nice to see for, you know, the leaders that we have here. This works really great with leadership. I enjoyed it. Okay. Now we go on to Namaris. Are you ready?
No. I'm nervous. I'm so nervous, y'all. If y'all hear my voice shaking or like some heavy breathing, like, y'all, I'm nervous.
It's okay. You're amongst friends. A lot of you are doing it for the first time, so you definitely got this.
All right, so let's see if I can clear this up. Y'all can hear me okay, right?
Yes.
All right, can you guys see my screen?
Yes. We see our bubbles.
Okay, I think I got it.
There we go. Yep.
All right. So, as you guys can see, my topic is going to be about the dark web. Now, I'm sure we've all heard about it, but tonight, let's just talk about it. I'm going to be talking about the different layers of the web. What is the dark web? Why it exists? What can be accessed on it? What is Tor? And why we should avoid the dark web. But let me first introduce myself. My name is Namaris. And if I may be honest, I didn't think this was real, like, at all. Like, to me, the dark web was some exaggerated glorification of dark hacking, illegal destruction of the world, and the black market. It was something that I've always seen and heard about on TV shows and in movies. Though once I started my journey in cybersecurity, I learned that the dark web is very real and should not be messed with. So let's get back to the basics. We're going to start off with the three layers. The World Wide Web is known to have three major components. We have the surface web, the deep web, and the dark web. We'll first be talking about the surface web. The surface web consists of over 4 billion pages and counting, and that only takes up about 10% of the whole web. It can be accessed via standard search engines like Google Chrome, Internet Explorer, Mozilla Firefox, and many others. It's also visible to all users of the internet to look up sites like blogs, news articles, and any other public site available using the search engines mentioned above. Though, as public and small as it may seem, it doesn't make it the safest. It's actually very easy to be vulnerable on the surface web. Within those 4 billion sites, many of them are malicious sites and scams that can cause harm. So it's important to note that using special security services and practices will be beneficial to use in this level. Next up, we have the deep web. It's the largest layer of the three, going at about 90 to 95% of the web. It's the layer that's not so easily accessible as the surface web. The data here can't just be found on like a search engine like Google. These entities are usually accessed through some sort of username and password like type of login. The deep web can be used to access databases, forums, social media apps, emails, online banking, chat messages, health records, and fee-for-services sites. Now, while it's important to be secure on the surface level, this is the area where you really want to apply those strong security practices, such as creating those long, strong passwords and using a VPN service. You might want to think twice about accessing like your private information while going on like public networks. Now, onto the most dangerous part of the internet, the dark web. There is actually little to no information on how it got created. The dark web is the third part of the web level or the internet, and it only takes up a very small portion of the internet. But why is it there? Why does it exist? Well, that's because it's the home for cyber criminals and hackers. Everything illegal you can find here. Drug trafficking, illegal weapons, fraud, contract killings, cyber attacking services, and I'm sure there's so much more at this point. As crazy as it sounds, this world really does exist. And I just wanted to put in a side note on what cyber attacking services can consist of. And that's botnets, which is short for a robot network. And they're a network of computers that are infected by malware. These include attacks about email spams and DDoS attacks. But that term, black market, it's true. There are illegal marketplaces and forums where actual criminal activities are being conducted and discussed. Now, I don't know any specifics on what's being talked about, so don't go and message me trying to get the tea on what's going on the dark web. I'm only here to inform you that such things do exist. Now, let me just start off by saying another thing. That I'm not going to show you what it looks like, how to use it, or anything like that. It wasn't allowed for this presentation, which is cool, no sweat. But I'm going to inform you about something called Tor. Now, Tor is a network that allows for private web browsing. It stands for the Onion Router. It's a browser that was created back in the mid-1990s, and it was meant to keep like the US intelligence secrets safe and secure. In the early 2000s, it was made available to the public as an open source platform. It operates by using three layers of encryption and a specific onion-style routing method that allows users to be anonymous. Instead of directly connecting your computer to a website, it bounces between other users before delivering what's wanted. It allows for the user to browse the internet, basically minimizing the risk of being traced. So if you look at this image here, you can see there's like three nodes. You have the entry node, the middle nodes, and an exit node. The entry node is when your data is being introduced to the Tor circuit. The middle nodes are, this is where the encryption happens. Your data is sent through multiple thousands and thousands of nodes to quote unquote replace your identity one after the other. Say your data went through node A, then node P, then node K, then node Y. Y only knows the identity of node K, who only knows the identity of node P, and so on and so forth. This is how Tor ensures that, or keeps that anonymous vibe within its network. Then you have the exit node, which allows the data to reach its final server destination. Sounds pretty cool, right? Because it is. Overall, the network itself is safe and legal to use. It's even free. Anyone can use it. There might be someone who just wants is a very private person and does not want to risk like even the slightest chance of being scammed or being a victim of identity theft to occur. Like, you know, I've been there. It's not fun. Some government agencies still use Tor. Major for-profit organizations like Walmart or PepsiCo, journalists, activists, like literally anyone can use it. It's just those benefits of Tor that creates these malicious and criminal acts to occur. And I also wanted to mention as well that even though its purpose is to make people anonymous, you're not 100% like out the loop. There's always a loophole. And just because it's hard to find you, it doesn't make it impossible. So you're not, you know, what was that? Okay, so it's important to say that you want to stay safe. It's unfortunate to say as well that if there's any chance that you've been hacked or your information has been exposed, that it could already be in the dark web ready for someone to buy. And yes, hackers will take personal information not only for themselves, but to sell on the black market to another criminal and make a profit out of it, out of you. So get that anti-malware protection, get a VPN, create those long, annoying, complicated passwords. For example, you don't want to use password 1234. Instead, use something like how I have here. I'm not going to read this all out, but something that's unrelated to you personally, but not completely foreign that you'd forget it. And here's a little quote that I wanted to share with everyone because I thought it was important. And it was very informative. If it's smart, it's vulnerable. So definitely keep that in mind. And this brings me to the end of my presentation. It wasn't anything spectacular, but I hope it was, you know, informative for anyone who may have needed it or anyone who may have just needed a refresher. I know for me, this was very, very interesting because I'm new into this field. I come from like, you know, the medical field. So in my journey of like learning on the IT side of things, it's definitely interesting. And this definitely caught my eye. So, but yeah, these are my resources here. And everyone, remember to stay safe and to keep off the dark web. That'll be it. Thank you.
Excellent job. That was great.
Thank you. Thank you.
And just enough information for me not to worry.
See, I told you I was keeping it.
That was good. It was good. Very good. Not gonna mess with the spooky web. awesome. All right. Who's next? Shay?
Yes, Shay is in the building. I am in the building.
Steganography. Yeah. Thank you. Because yeah. I couldn't
good
say.
Good job, Mia Morris. You did good. See, it wasn't yeah. a thing.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. I was even going to say, if you want me to go kind of break the ice, you know, I was going to volunteer, but I knew you got this.
She did great.
All right. Let me see. I'm going to share my screen. We'll jump right into it. Let's see, which screen do I want? Choose which screen. Okay. Select this. Let's see, entire screen. And I think it's going to be this one. Yeah? High five. Can you guys see? Is that the right one?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. All right. Good evening, everyone. And thank you for joining me in this masterclass presentation on steganography. Unveiling the Art of Concealment. I am your presenter, Shay. Let's see. So tonight's agenda, I'm going to kind of go through it really fast because I really want to jump into the demo. I'm going to give you a brief definition and overview, kind of discuss its historical context, and then I'll discuss how it can be used from both an ethical and unethical standpoint, and then kind of highlight a real-world use case involving the CIA. And its intelligence operations as it pertains to Iran and later on China. I'll also kind of go over the role steganography plays in how information security is assessed. And then, like I said, I have a VM spun up, so I'm gonna jump in and give you guys a demo of how easy it actually is and the different ways that you can utilize it. All right, so imagine a world where secrets are hidden in plain sight, disguised within innocent-looking images, audios, or text files. Welcome to the realm of steganography, the art of covert communication. So what is steganography? It's the technical definition is derived from steganos, which means covered or concealed, and grapheme, which means writing or drawing. And it's basically the practice of hiding information within data. From a security standpoint, steganography is the practice of concealing one piece of information within another, typically by hiding either like a message or data within different files, images, audio, even video, so that on the surface, everything appears to be normal. The primary objective is to ensure that the hidden information is not easily detectable by anyone who either does not have the means to decrypt it or extract the data or even have knowledge of its its existence or where to look. And that goes for both an ethical and unethical purposes. Some people kind of confuse steganography with cryptography, but where the two differ is that steganography is it's all about concealing the fact that additional data even exists, where cryptography is concerned with protecting the data through the use of algorithms. Ethical application, it's a versatile technique that actually has numerous legitimate uses across different fields. With data security, steganography provides a solution that addresses concerns of data secure data transmission, protection against data theft, and sensitive document storage. Organizations might use it as a means to ensure confidentiality when data needs to be sent over public networks. Hiding critical data and otherwise meaningless looking files is another way that it serves as an additional layer of defense by reducing the likelihood that theft of that data will take place. And embedding critical information allows an organization to store and archive it in such a manner that prevents unauthorized access. And one of the few instances where steganography isn't trying to be so covert is in copyright protection, and the most common form being the digital watermarks that content creators use to safeguard their intellectual property, kind of as seen in this picture here, where you kind of see it preview. So that's still considered steganography. And then, of course, it's used to ensure the authenticity of documents by acting as sort of like a digital signature or a fingerprint. The goal is to make the product tamper-proof. And a perfect example that everyone knows about and probably handles on a daily basis is money. Currency is another great example of how steganography is used, and in the form of color shifting ink, UV and infrared ink, microprinting, hidden images, and even security threads, as well as watermarks. Now, on the flip side, for most legitimate uses, there are, of course, counterparts. So where covert communication is used to protect classified or secret, you know, information, we undoubtedly experience instances where criminals use steganography to hide instructions, plans, sensitive information, and, as I'll show you, payloads, as well as stagers that will perform functions on their behalf without much user interaction. They use this method as a means of coordinating cyber attacks and distributing malware, planning criminal operations, foreign intelligence agencies and spies, and even perhaps terrorist groups might employ steganography and hang out with Neomaris on the dark web doing their onion tea stuff. A couple of weeks ago, I remember Nick talked about piracy and how one of the ramifications of engaging in theft of copyrighted material is that you might download something that contains malware, which is probably the most kind of common reason for using pirated software. But steganography is also used as a means to circumvent digital rights management protections. What individuals will do is they'll hide copyrighted content within legitimate files to evade detection and then distribute that copyrighted material illegally. Malicious actors can also hide stolen data. If they're trying to exfiltrate stuff and they kind of want to stay under the radar and make it look like these things are normal processes, then it's a tactic that they'll use to make it harder for security systems to detect. And then I'll show you kind of a proof of concept later where that can be done. Criminals use it to embed malicious code and malware within files, bypassing security measures and infecting target systems, which will enable them to run commands, install programs, communicate with a C2 server, et cetera, et cetera. And see, like, great minds think alike, Neomaris. I have a quote too. Sometimes the most effective form of communication is the one that no one notices. And that was by David Goyer, who's a screenwriter for the Dark Knight trilogy. A use case was the CIA comms communication catastrophe. So from around 2009 to 2013, the intelligence community kind of like experienced really crushing failures related to its secret internet-based communication system, which was a key means for remote messaging between CIA officers and then their sources, but primarily in China and Iran, where the problem originated and then spiderwebbed to other countries, despite warnings about what could happen. One of the largest failures occurred or started in Iran around 2009, which was a little after the Stuxnet virus. You know, Iran was kind of angered about the breach and the damage that was caused by that virus. And so they knew that there was some kind of mole. And it really didn't take them a lot of time to figure it out, because the communication system that the CIA was using was extremely flawed. The risks that posed by the system appeared to have been overlooked in part because it was really easy to use, with even the CIA's directorate saying that it was impregnable. But about a year later, around 2010, Iran had already started to identify CIA agents. And within a year after that, had already dismantled their network in that country, based on, you know, reports from other former intelligence officials. The use of sloppy steganography and messaging platforms that were operated by the CIA, and it's like over 300 websites, had led to the capture and prosecution and most likely execution of numerous Iranian informants who were working with the United States and providing them with military intelligence and other sensitive state secrets. So the lesson here was, even though it can be a powerful means to conceal information, putting too much trust into that methodology can lead to having like a false sense of security and overconfidence in one's ability to go and remain undetected, as we saw, hubris, arrogance, and even a lack of conviction to ensure a certain level of protection to those who are helping you out ended up costing people their lives and freedom. And it really destroyed the trust and credibility that the U.S. had established with Iranian nationals. Okay, demonstration time. So before I kind of go into the VM, I'm going to kind of just go over briefly the tools that I'm going to be using. One of them is called StegHide. It's a open source tool. It works on all platforms, so it doesn't matter if you're running Windows, Linux, Mac, it'll work. StegHide allows users to embed a variety of data types, and it supports JPEG, PNG, bitmap, although bitmap tends to be a little bit larger in size. And compressed formats like JPEG and PNG work better. WAV files are also supported. The only downside to StegHide is that movie files are not supported. And then another important thing to remember is that if StegHide is used to embed data, it also must be used to extract it. So this would be a tool that would be used between two parties that want to communicate covertly and use traditional forms of communication to conduct their covert communication. So it would already be understood that data or media that would be, you know, being sent over the wire has some form of hidden message that they would, you know, they would on their end know how to extract and decode. And a cool feature about it is that you can password protect the embedded data. So you set a password, and whoever wants to extract that data would need the password. The other one, it's a command line tool. It's called EXIF tool. And this thing is like super powerful. It has an extensive library for reading and writing and also manipulating metadata, which is like data about data. Just like StegHide, it's also cross-platform, and it doesn't stop at just audio and images for its capabilities. You can use EXIF tool for video, raw files, documents, HTML. You can embed stuff in fonts, archives, It can handle geospatial data formats like GPX and GPS, and it can even interact with file system metadata like permissions and owner information, and modify timestamps on Unix and Linux environments. So it's a really powerful tool. So what I'll do is I'm going to show you guys how I can embed Base64 encoded scripting, and then utilize automation to perform functions on a victim's computer without them knowing that I did anything. So let me go ahead and jump into that. Can you guys see? You still see my Kali up, VM up?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So, oh, dang, I still have my Huntress stuff up. Okay, sorry. okay. Let's go ahead and get rid of you. So we're going to go into demo. And I've already written out the scripts, and I'll go over them so that you guys can see. So we'll start with these pictures here. These will be my starter pictures. And I'll use one for each different kind of demo. The first one that I'm going to do, I'm going to go ahead and do the stake hide one. And so what I have here are two different, can you guys, is it not big enough? All right. So I have two different scripts that I wrote. Let me go ahead and open this up and kind of show you what this one is. So here, what I've done is I've kind of created some variables that have some predefined information as far as where the secret file is located, what kind of picture I'm going to use, the name of the output image, because once I embed this picture with this file, it'll output this image. This is the passphrase that I'm going to use. Just keep it simple. I have some error checking here. So this is kind of my way of like seeing if there's any bugs. Then I get little messages, but I've already kind of gone through this and it worked just fine. So this right here, this particular script will simply just encode the or embed the image. It's going to take this file right here and it's going to put it in this picture. And then this picture will have another picture. And that would be the one that I would send to whoever I want to communicate with. And then on their end, we would just pretend like they got the picture. This would be something that they would have to do to extract the file. And so here's what they would run. They would, you know, extract more variables to define locations and passphrases. And then the actual extracting the file is this one right here. Is this stake hide extract. It calls this variable here an output file. It uses the passphrase. And so what I did was I decided to use the demo directory and this file name to show how this file and then where it will, the other one will show up over here, and this file will be the same. So I'll pull up a terminal and go ahead and scripts. All right. So for the first one, I'll do stake hide. Go ahead and run that. And you see here, oops, can I zoom in on this? Dang it, I can't. I don't know how, at least I don't. So here you see file embedded successfully with passphrase. And as we can see, here is our other picture. You'll also notice that the size of this file is a little bit bigger here, since 205 and this is 192. So it has now this file in it. And the other person would then get this picture. You'd already prearranged the password that you would need to extract it. So I'll go ahead and you'll see as I run this, as I run this other command, or this other program, the text file pop up over here. Oh, we're going to have Steg unhide. And there it is. So here is the extracted file. I'll go ahead and open this up. It's a secret message. And just for confirmation, proof of concept, we'll pull this one up, secret file, and you see they're the same. All right. Now for the other one is going to be a little bit more malicious, or can be, as an example, how malicious actors can use this kind of tactic to, you know, do remote code execution, download, install, and really kind of run amok. So again, it's a two-part thing where I have a payload and I have a stager. I'll go ahead and start with the payload and show you what this looks like. So what this is doing here is this is going to be the proof of concept that I have access to a system and that I can install files on someone's system. What this is doing here is it's creating a variable that I later call to pass through to be encoded. And I then embed base64 content into a picture. And then what I will do is create my own user-defined metadata tag called certificate so that it looks professional or anything that you wouldn't kind of like, you know, an unsuspecting person wouldn't think twice about it. It creates its own user. I create my own user defined meta tag, and then I embed the base64 command. So this is what would get embedded as base64 content. The stager, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to like on purpose kind of like make it hang so that you'll see that the error checking at the bottom, you'll see this come up because when you go to execute, where you actually need to download it, it needs to then be extracted, converted again, and then evaluated. There's a thing that I wanted to show you guys, the difference between just pulling a URL and then having to like go a little one step further and getting the complete URL with the pictures extension so that it downloads properly. Here I would then put the URL in this place. I left it open because I don't know what it's going to be yet. In this section I'm defining my staging directory and the name of the picture that I'm going to be downloading, the output file of it. I've got some more error checking here where if there's any kind of issues, it'll tell me that it didn't download. Over here, this is the part where I'm extracting the data. So I'm running ExifTool again, and I'm piping it into awk where I'm isolating that line where it's that user-defined meta tag, and then deleting spaces and colons, and I'm just pulling what would be then the second column. That's what this part here is. And so all I have is in my variable just the base64 encoded content. I then bring it over here to where I'm going to go ahead and pipe that into base64 to decode. And then once it's been converted into this again, I'm going to go ahead and execute it. And then at the end, I do a little bit of cleanup. So I will put just like, again, for proof of concept, this is where the file will show up if all this stuff runs correctly. And then I do cleanup. So I go back, I make sure that the temp directory is deleted so that there's no proof that I was there. There's no cookies. There's no IOCs or anything like that. So first thing is to go ahead and run the payload. So I'll go ahead and run. And you should see here again, whale and whale GPG original. So this is the original file. This is without the encoding. This is the one that does have the encoding. It's very small. As you see, it's not really a major change in the size of the file. And to kind of get an idea of what it would look like, we're just going to run exit tool. I'm going to go ahead and pull this in here. And you'll get to see right here, certificate is what I defined. And here is my base 64 payload. And to look at this one so that you can see the difference between the two, there is no certificate part here. It has been completely stripped. So now I need to upload it. So we're going to host it. And I mean, it's kind of scary because this is a site that I found that does image hosting, bookmarks. And you don't even need to like log in. You don't need to register. You don't need to sign up for anything. You can create an account, but as you'll see, it would be like a perfect place for somebody who's, you know, doing some nefarious stuff to stage their malware. And I'll show you just how simple it is. I'm going to go ahead and take my picture. This is the one that's infected. I'm just going to drag it right here. And I can have the picture be auto-deleted in as little as 5 minutes after I upload it. So it will, it won't even leave any kind of trace on here. And it's going to upload with that base 64 encoding. Okay. Now we're going to go ahead and open this link. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you first what not to do. What you would typically do when you're using like URLs is you would go ahead and plug this into, payload stager. I would plug this in right here. Go ahead and save it. And I'm going to run this. And you see my error right here, file not found in demo. Well, everything worked except extraction. Because what ended up occurring was, and we can see that it downloaded just fine, because I'll go to my temp folder and we see there it is. But the problem is there's actually two problems. One, I pulled this page, which came with a bunch of garbage that I don't want. And it also stripped what I needed the most. So let's go ahead and find out what it really contained. Oops. You notice it's got all this garbage here. Whales, this Facebook stuff, image upload, but no certificate. And it was replaced with this token. So what do we do? How do we fix it? Well, we go here to share and we pull this part. Oops. Come on, you. All right. Go ahead and pull that. I'm going to replace my code with the full path. I'm going to go ahead and save it. I'm going to go back to my terminal. Where's my terminal? I'm going to go ahead and remove that image file. And now I'm going to rerun it. And we should see a you've been hacked file pop up. Boom. And there it is. You've been hacked. I can encrypt files. I can let them know this is the only document you're going to see. This is how you give me your money. This is where you got to send your stuff to. I'm hanging out on the dark web. And to double check, we see that it's no longer there because I cleaned it up. And yeah, so let me pull this up. Any questions? I'm going to go ahead and stop sharing. Any questions? Yay, nay, no?
I'm just... That was very cool.
Yeah. That was very cool. But you see, this is the stuff I was trying to talk about.
Yeah, exactly.
See, Nia Mars playing like she don't know. See, that's good. Yeah. She's keeping her cover. She like Mr. Robot going and you know, working as just a little quiet security consultant during the day, at night, busting people and exposing
I'm
them.
I'm dying.
Having a cop showing up. It's scary how easy it is. But imagine if I were to just use like and Kali is like really cool. Like there's a lot of cool tools in Kali. It's got its own social engineering toolkit where I mean you can hide stuff that is very quiet and it's very portable. I can send you something that I'm pretty sure with some like OSINT, some good OSINT, get you to click on something that looks like it's trusted. You won't even know that there was anything wrong with it because it's all done in the background and it will like kind of hijack already running processes. So it uses what's called as like living off the land. There's a term for lulboss, living off the land, where you're basically using the host machines or your target machines, its own environment, stuff that it is normal to its system. You click on this document. I'm waiting. I'm like I'm on my end. I've got I opened up a little server that I'm listening on a certain port. I mean, I busted out Python and I got my port listening for your connection. You connect to me and now I have access to your machine. See, it's one thing to like try to get into a person's home network by going through their router. That's harder because you'd have to like hack their router. You'd have to go in, do some port forwarding. There still may be like some security in place where it doesn't allow certain kind of connections. But the thing about firewalls is it's like the guy that collects or the woman that collects your ticket at a sporting event. You can't get into the sporting event unless you get your ticket, but it don't care who's leaving. And it's the same way with like network traffic. When you want to go look at the web, the firewall don't care. It's like, yeah, well, I'm letting everything come out because it's coming from within your private network. So it's already kind of feeling like this everything is trusted. So a reverse shell is just simply you on your end saying, hey, I want to talk to you without you knowing you even wanted to talk to me because I'm so cool. And then once I have that connection, then I go in and I'm doing all this stuff on your end. I'm going in and I'm using the command line to, you know, to curl and download documents. I've already got the stuff set up on my own side. I'm ready. I'm waiting. And then, oh yeah, you guys can't see anymore. But yeah, I go back to my image upload.
That is the crazy. That's the crazy scary part, is being able to get into someone else's system and do those things to them. And it's like, I don't have any questions. I'm just kind of, you know, back in why I've stopped watching those cyber hacking shows.
Well, you know, Nia Mars kind of like, you know, did me a solid by introducing the first half of how this stuff is actually done. I go through a VPN. I use a proxy.
Totally opened it up for you.
Yeah, I use a VPN. I use proxy chaining and Tor, the Tor browser. I upload my picture that has absolutely no personal identifiable information because I've stripped all the metadata from it. I've only curated what I wanted to put into it. I found a site that doesn't ask me for my name, my phone number, my address, my email. I don't need to go check no confirmation. I don't have to get multi-factor. I don't have to do none of that. I simply drag and drop. I get a link, and in 5 minutes, it's gone. And
well, you have to wonder what that image website has to do. What are they doing in the background too? You know.
Well, that's just
it's there for a reason.
They are, even if they are logging, traffic. Guess what? I hit you guys up from Finland. My Tor, like the cool thing about VPN and that Tor is that what they see is an IP address from somewhere else.
Yeah.
And it goes to at least three. Like that's the minimum is three. And if I'm doing it on my computer, I'm first going to establish how I'm going to do it. Like if I wanted to do it, and I know I wouldn't get, like, it would be very hard to trace it back. I would set up, I would set up a Bastion server. So I would do a VPN into a cloud EC2 instance that's running, that's running a VPN software, because free VPN, they're still selling your stuff. Like if you see VPN services, you can get free VPN, and they're most likely selling your information to be able to cover the cost of hosting your browsing. They also will kind of like reduce how much browsing you can do, so you won't be able to have a lot of data. So they'll have a limit on it. But I would actually set up my own. I'd have my own like firewalls in place, and I would do it through like a cloud server. And then so I would connect from my computer through the VPN on a cloud server. From there, I'm gonna use what's known as Tails. I actually talked about this yesterday with Gary. There's an operating system called Tails, which is called the Amnesiac Incognito Live System. It doesn't store any of whatever you're doing while you're on it. I'd run through Tails through its Tor browser, and I would actually do like maybe 8 or 9 different connections for proxy chaining. So by the time I get to image upload, I've routed through 7 countries, a VPN tunnel, a Bastion router, and a cloud server that's running my own VPN software. And then I'm on, and then it comes back to my home. And even then, I might not even use my own router. I mean, I'd probably hack somebody else.
You're right, Gary. Yeah, you can hear the passion. He's definitely found what he likes to do. That's for sure. Yeah. And you better leave your mic on so we can hear if somebody comes, you know, if the feds come banging down your door. So
you know, they're already listening, and I'm not even
worried. I know.
Me and Gary, we be talking about it. Like, you know what? I'm all for the NSA. Let them know how I get down.
That's
I'm
what I say. They can come here. Saying? They won't find anything.
I hope they listen and please be paying attention. Yes, I am Middle Eastern.
Yeah, pay attention.
You know,
and you'll work for them.
American.
You have no problems working for them and showing them how it's done.
Nope.
Exactly.
Nope, I don't.
All right. We
care.
Should move on because we have a lot of people to go on. But this was great. It was excellent. Very good information. Nice.
Thank you. Keep going. You. I appreciate it.
Yes. Charlene, I believe you are next.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Just share my screen. Can you guys see this right here?
Yes.
Okay, awesome. Okay, so my presentation is about conflict resolution. So what is conflict? Conflict is opposing views that cause disagreements between people. I'm sure that a lot of you have been working for a good amount of time. Whether you like it or not, you will encounter conflict in the workplace, even if you try your best to avoid it. Sometimes conflict can be work-related. Other times, it might be personal. Even people who consider themselves as laid-back and easygoing can find themselves stuck in a conflict. This is something that we all face one way or the other, and it's best to think of how you would handle things when you're faced with a situation. I'm currently in a management role, but before I was promoted, I was the type to keep my head down at work, do the tasks that I'm supposed to do, try to do my best, and go home. Even though I tried to keep to myself, I was still faced with conflicts that I had to address. If you do a search online, you will find that there are a lot of different types of conflict, but I chose these three because these cover a good range of conflicts in the workplace. Task conflict pertains to opinions on topics that relate to employee expectations, resources, and policies. These are policies and expectations on what the employee is responsible for. Examples are computer use, attendance policies, or meeting deadlines. Relationship conflict is about differences between employees. This can range from personality, work styles, and how one handles issues that may arise. This refers to someone's being and how they operate as a person. It could be that someone is an introvert, extrovert, type A or type B, someone who is reserved versus someone who is very outspoken. Value conflict refers to their belief systems, such as morals, culture, politics, religion, and diversity. It's whether someone is a Democrat, Republican, atheist, Christian, pro-choice, or pro-life. There are a few things that can cause conflict. Miscommunications can pertain to expectations that have been set but were not interpreted correctly by an employee. For example, if a type A boss assigns an employee a task but does not give them a deadline, the employee may expect that it is not a high priority item. But since the boss has a type A personality, they probably expect for you to complete that task ASAP, even though there were no deadlines mentioned. Differences in values can be simple as someone not liking a person after they find out what political party they belong to. There are a lot of different types of personalities at work, and sometimes some of these people just don't mesh well together. Someone who has a very high sense of urgency paired with someone who works at a slower pace may not be a good fit depending on the project. Managers need to be aware that every decision they make can potentially result in a conflict, and they need to be mindful of who it will impact and what solutions they could bring to the table. It is best to always think steps ahead instead of only thinking of the present moment. When an issue is not addressed, it will keep occurring. The person, for all you know, may not even know that they are doing something wrong. On the other hand, a person may deliberately be doing what they're not supposed to because they know that they are getting away with it since no one has said something to them. If you bring it to their attention, they are given the opportunity to change their behavior. Depending on how problematic the issue is, you may have to go down the chain of command if the problem does not get fixed after talking to the individual. For example, if the employee is an office administrator, your complaint should go to their direct manager. If that direct manager does not correct that behavior after a given amount of time and the problem still persists, escalate it to the general manager. If that does not get resolved, go to the next person, and that could be the district manager, and your last stop should be HR. Start from the lower level first, then work your way up. Depending on the circumstance, the manager that you report the issue to may even escalate it themselves. There are different problems that may arise from the workplace. An issue with dress code should be handled differently than someone who is drinking on the job. If an employee constantly gets away with not submitting their work on time, the high-performing employees may start feeling resentful of management because they feel that they are not treating everyone equally and management is playing favorites. Not only can this be damaging to your relationship with your coworkers, but this can also result in low morale in the company and can hurt productivity. There are different benefits to conflict resolution. It could reduce stress. If you had an issue at work, you know how stressful it is and how it can get. There have been countless nights where I toss and turn in bed, stressing out about my workday in the morning. You end up losing sleep and you're more irritable than usual, and it could start spilling into your personal life as well. Conflict resolution can improve performance. Once the issue gets addressed, it will be a big weight off your shoulders and you could focus on more important things. You can then start focusing on how you can perform your tasks effectively and efficiently. I've had conflicts in the past where it consumed me to the point where I was reading my emails, but I could not comprehend what I was reading because I was so flustered by the situation. Conflict resolution can demonstrate competency and increase trust. If there is a perceived conflict, you can ask your coworkers to clarify what they meant if it was something that you took offense to. Even if there are opposing views, the other person can explain their point of view. Sometimes, even if you don't have the same beliefs, you may understand when someone is coming from and their actions were not meant to be hurtful. This can show others that you are open to dialogue and that you are willing to discuss difference in a professional manner. Conflict resolution can advance you to leadership. Being able to step up and address the problem head on may show others that you're not afraid to tackle hard issues that no one wants to address. If you handle situations correctly, this could show everyone that you can remain calm under pressure and you have everything under control. De-escalating a situation is not a skill that everyone automatically has, but with enough practice, it could come as second nature. There are different styles in conflict resolution. Accommodating style is putting others' concerns first before yours. Even if you think someone is wrong, you simply agree to disagree to keep the peace. These conflict styles don't just apply to coworkers, they can apply to customers as well, in addition to relationships in your personal life. In this type of style, you can be accommodating to customers with their needs because you want to give them a good experience with your company. Avoiding style is when someone ignores the problem altogether and hope that it goes away. Compromising style is finding a way to meet in the middle. An example is if a customer was not happy with their experience with your company, you could offer them a discount on their next purchase, and that usually helps smooth things over. Collaborating style is finding a solution that everybody can be happy with. When I started working for the company that I'm currently with, the start time for work was 7 a.m. They noticed that I was sluggish in the morning, but I still got the work done and my boss didn't really have a problem with it, but she was slightly bothered. So my boss asked me the question that made her realize that I worked a second job. She asked me what time I thought would be a great start time for me, and I told her 9 a.m. would be great, even though I didn't expect for her to change my start time. She did end up changing start time to 9 a.m. with the expectation that I still did my 8-hour shift. And if I needed to come in earlier than 9 a.m., I was more than welcome to. Really appreciated that. So competing style is sticking to your own views and not compromising with anyone. It could be an employee who is complaining about the dress code policy, but you stick to the policy knowing that is the same across the board and it is fair for everyone. Active listening involves allowing the other person to talk by giving them your full attention. Do not interrupt them while they're talking and let them finish what they have to say. Allow for them to finish their train of thought. Try not to think of your response while the person is talking. If you are too worried about what you are going to say next, you will not hear the other person's side of the story because you are too wrapped up in your own thoughts. Make eye contact with the person while they are talking, but be aware of how you are looking at them. I actually had this problem as a kid. Whenever my mom would reprimand me, I would have eye contact, but she told me I looked like I wanted to kill her. So I'm working on that as an adult right now, and kind of challenging, to be quite honest. And beware of your body language. How you're sitting down during a conversation can show your interest or lack of thereof. If you are slouching, this shows your disinterest in what the other person has to say. If you're leaning forward, this shows that you are listening and are open in what they are discussing with you. Being assertive does not necessarily mean that you are asserting dominance. This simply means that you can speak up for yourself in a respectful manner. Be direct, but not disrespectful. Try not to raise your voice when you're speaking about something that you're passionate about. Instead of being heard, this can trigger the other person's fight or flight response instead of being able to have a productive conversation. So I'm sure that you guys see the videos online and they call people Karens. It's because instead of having a polite conversation while still being assertive, those people tend to throw a fit and nobody ends up talking, well, taking them seriously. When having a discussion, try to understand where the other person is coming from. Maybe they are going through something personal outside of the conflict that you are both faced with. Yes, it does not allow them the right to act in a negative way, but you are also helping them realize that their actions are also affecting others around them, and it's not just them who are being affected by it. Having empathy for others allow for you to be more forgiving when you know the circumstances they are faced with. When conflict initially happens, it would be best to clear things up right away. This way, there can be no misunderstandings. It is good to paraphrase what you think the other person has said and repeat it to them so the other person can confirm whether you not fully understood what they had said. Even after talking it through and understanding what the conflict is, you may still not agree with the other person. This will be the time to brainstorm on other possible outcomes where you could both agree. If that still does not work, find a private place where you can discuss the conflict. It's unprofessional to discuss your conflict out in the open, and it makes everyone who is not involved uncomfortable. Others also don't need to know what you are having the conflict with someone. That is how word gossip gets started in the first place. And some like to insert themselves even though the conflict does not pertain to them. Hear what the other person has to say and practice active listening. If you're not sure you understand the other person correctly, ask for clarification as to what they meant and do not assume. Again, paraphrase what they said to confirm that you understand. If there are more than two people involved in the conflict, ask for others to share their thoughts and opinions to the group. They may have different insights and may bring a different light to the conversation. Depending on the conflict, you may have to identify a common goal and start working towards it. Who knows? You know, you may have the same vision, but different ways of working towards the goal. Pros and cons can be discussed, and brainstorming should occur for both parties to come to an agreement. If both parties still cannot come to an agreement, you may have to invite a third party to sit in during your conflict resolution. It is best to find someone who is neutral to the conflict. The mediator basically is there as a referee who can make sure that both sides are getting their turn to express themselves. They can make sure that the conversation remains respectful while getting their points across. An action plan should be made as to how the conflict would be handled moving forward. So, in conclusion, if everyone just sat down to discuss their differences, it will bring everyone closer together because they will have a better understanding with how the person operates, and misunderstandings can be clarified. The more you know about how another person thinks or views things, the better your team can perform. You can gain much mutual respect by being able to respectfully sit down and listen to another person with an opposing view. When problems are discussed and solutions are made, team morale goes up. Be more open to other people's differences. So thank you for coming to my TED Talk. And here are my references.
Great job.
Thank you.
I loved it. Lots of good information. A lot of things we don't realize we need to remember and understand when you're speaking with someone. And I hate to say it, I love and hate the Karen videos. So
I do too. To be honest, they're so entertaining.
They are, but I'm like, oh my God, how could they be like that? Oh, what an awful person. Okay. Next is Anna.
Hi, everyone. Let me share my screen. And if you can just confirm that you can see it.
I can see it.
So my presentation topic is on managing risk in an organization. And this probably looks very familiar. So it happened that Charlene and I selected the same PowerPoint theme. Good day, Charlene. So this is my second masterclass presentation, and perhaps before I'm going to start, I should give a little background, maybe introduction. So when it comes to risk management, you know, I'm familiar, just not probably many of you, with risk assessment and many different parts of the whole process, but I did have an understanding that there was a much bigger picture here, a much larger process. And I just want to take this opportunity to discover what the whole process is, and you know, from beginning for an organization, how to set it up and how to be effective, have an effective risk management. So cybersecurity risk management is an ongoing and systematic process in which we identify, analyze, evaluate, and address threats to organizations' operations and its mission. And the primary goal is to maintain the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of critical assets against all threats and vulnerabilities. It provides a structured approach that helps organizations anticipate and address threats that could affect the company's ability to meet strategic, operational, financial, and compliance goals. Benefits. Risk management is important because it assesses the company's current cybersecurity risk profile. In turn, it informs decisions the organization will make moving forward in order to reduce the level of risk and address vulnerabilities in a comprehensive and consistent manner. It also offers an organization-wide situational awareness that provides ability to look at all the information available, recognize what's important, and have a clear understanding of the risks. And then it allows the organization to act accordingly. There are several cybersecurity risk management frameworks available, each designed to help organizations assess, manage, and mitigate the cybersecurity risks. So there are these frameworks vary in scope, focus, and applicability. Some are developed specifically to guide the risk management process, such as the factor analysis of information risk, the FAIR framework for understanding, analyzing, and quantifying information risk in financial terms, or the NIST risk management framework, the RMF, and the supporting publication, the NIST special publication 830-37-39, which have been developed by the National Institute of Standards and Technology to guide risk assessment and management. The NIST RMF is one of the most widely recognized and commonly used cybersecurity risk management frameworks. There are also other frameworks where the risk management guidelines are just a part of a wider scope. And those are, for example, the ISO 27 2001, which provides standards for establishing, implementing, and maintaining, and also continue improving the information security management systems. And there is also the NIST Cybersecurity Framework, which provides a comprehensive set of guidelines and best practices for organizations to manage and reduce their cybersecurity risk overall. So developing a risk management program within an organization initially involves identifying what it is that the organization needs to protect. The first step is to identify assets that have value or are critical to the operation and mission of the organization. And those can range from people, such as employees, customers, business partners, contractors, to information like intellectual property or PII, or software system, physical assets like buildings, plant equipment, cars, storage media, or even paper prints, to outsourced communication services, third-party providers, supply chain, or even a corporate identity. In the second step, we would want to assign value to those assets, or a relative worth that those assets represent to an organization. And we do that by determining the asset's criticality, which is based on adverse impact to the organization, the business functions or the operations, if those assets were to be compromised. The NIST risk management framework guides us to categorize all of those assets value as low, moderate, or high. And there is also a publication that has been developed by NIST, and this is the Federal Information Processing Standard, the FIPS 199, which provides standards for categorizing all of the secure assets and the information, which is a really good resource. So next, we would want to perform a comprehensive risk assessment. And that starts with recognizing potential threats to those assets that we have previously identified. And then we would want to determine the likelihood that those threats can be compromised, or the threats that can be compromised. Then finally, we would want to define the vulnerability, which is weaknesses or flaws in organization's security posture that expose the assets to some type of danger or compromise. And finally, based on all of those factors, we then define the severity of risk. And there are two approaches here. One is the qualitative, which is based on observation. It may we may assign value as low, medium, or high in here. And then the other one is quantitative approach, which this is where the risk calculation attempts to create hard numbers using, for example, a historical data. And there is a NIST special publication 830 that provides a guide for conducting risk assessments. Again, it's a fantastic resource. So now that we have identified the risk to assets, we need to develop a mitigation strategies. And the best way to do that is by selecting and then implementing security controls or practices to safeguard the information systems and the assets within an organization. And there are many frameworks to choose from in here, but the most widely used by all branches of the federal government and then adapted by many other industries throughout the whole world is the NIST Special Publication 853 framework. This framework is like a catalog of secure controls. It consists of 20 domains or families and over 1,000 controls that organization can choose from to design their very own security program. It is designed to be tailored based on the organization risk tolerance, the mission, and the system environment, which means that organization will need to adapt a subset of the controls that are most applicable to their very own needs. And the controls are intentionally also not focused on any specific technology. So you want to think of them as goals, where each organization will have to adapt a customized approach for achieving those goals based on their own situation or their own environment again. And then once we select a set of security controls, then the next step is to implement them. And the implementation includes operational, management, and technical security controls, which means that besides installing, let's say, new technologies or configuring security settings, there are other types of activities that are also critical, such as implementing policies, plans, and operational procedures, performing comprehensive employee training, building incident response internal capabilities, and governance, just few. Also, there are some things to consider while selecting the controls. Things like regulatory compliance, which usually is tied to the type of data that the company handles, or other industry-specific requirements. Things to consider are, again, confidentiality, integrity, and availability priority based on the business needs and the business profile, and the business risk tolerance. Next, we would want to develop a strategy to manage the risk, or a strategy to continually reduce risk to a level that is considered acceptable to the organization, which is also called the risk appetite. And the first step in this process is to assess the controls. And we can do that by testing the implementation to determine the security control effectiveness. In other words, are the controls implemented correctly? Are they operating as intended and meeting the security requirements for the systems and the environment in operation? So there are three assessment methods in here. The first one's interview individuals or group of individuals. The second one is examining the specification, the mechanism or activities, such as examination of the documentation, policies, software functionalities, or system administration. And the third one is testing of those mechanisms or activities. And then next, we would want to make sure that the system needs to be authorized. And this is where the authorizing official within the organization examines the results of the secure control assessment, the gap assessment, to determine whether or not the residual risk is acceptable for their organization. And then finally, after that, we would want to continuously monitor the controls. So incorporate all the monitoring into an integrated organizational-wide monitoring program, and which will be looking and continually searching for any changes or any signs of attack. And we also need to reassess the control's effectiveness on a regular basis, which means the performing the gap assessment at minimum once a year. So those are the six steps of the complete risk management framework. And here are my references. And I hope you enjoy my presentation. Are there any questions or comments?
That was great. So much so, we need to do a risk assessment for PGIP. I have said this for years and years and years, and we just haven't done it.
Awesome. Thank you.
So I will be calling on you for that as soon as I get it through with the execs and stuff. We'll get that figured out, because we really do need to get that for all departments and for PGIP. We don't want to lose everything. Great job. Excellent job.
Thank you.
Okay. I will show the one for James now and tell you what, let's do Abian. You go ahead, and then I'll show James, because it's a recording. You guys can always watch that at another time if you want to. But let's go ahead with Abian. You can present yours.
Okay. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Let me see how I can screen share this. I'm sorry. Here it is. Okay. Can you see the screen, please?
I see your calendar.
Okay. Do you see the presentation?
Now I see it, yes.
Okay. So if I can just... Oh, Lord. I'm sorry. This... I don't really use this. I'm sorry.
You can hit the... at the bottom of the screen, hit that little... Looks like a book.
This one?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, here it is. Thank you. Okay. So, hello, everyone. Today, my presentation will be about holding a professional image in cybersecurity. However, this can be taken in any sort of field, but because I'm in cybersecurity, I'll be doing for cybersecurity. While maintaining a professional image is essential, it is also critical to recognize that cybersecurity is a field driven by expertise and results. Concentrating solely on appearance-related factors can be deceptive. This presentation seeks to broaden the audience's perspective by emphasizing that a professional image consists of more than just an attire and behaviors. It entails constantly honing your skills, staying current among emergency threats, actively participating in professional networks, and showcasing your achievements. By emphasizing these aspects, you will not only project competency, credibility, but you will also lay the groundwork for long-term success in cybersecurity. Remember that it is your combination of professional image and substantive expertise that truly distinguish yourself in this industry. While a professional appearance is important, it's also important to understand that cybersecurity professionals aren't defined solely by their clothing. The emphasis on developing a responsible and competent mindset, dressing professionally is only one aspect of presenting a professional image. It's critical to demonstrate your expertise through your work by staying up to date on latest security trends and demonstrating your dedication to protecting digital assets. Remember that professionalism is more than just what you wear. It is also about your actions and expertise. A neat and appropriate appearance is essential in cybersecurity. Professionalism and attention to detail are reflected in well-fitting, wrinkle-free attire. Excessive jewelry, bright colors, and casual clothing should be avoided. Your appearance demonstrates respect for your organization and dedication to excellence. However, it is critical to remember that while appearance is important, it should not take precedence over core competencies. You should strive for a polished image while putting the substance of your cybersecurity work first. Maintaining a professional appearance is extremely important in the cybersecurity industry. Casual clothing, such as jeans, t-shirts, and sneakers, is generally regarded as unprofessional and may harm your credibility and reputation. Casual attire conveys the message that you may not take your job or organization seriously. You demonstrate a commitment to professionalism and convey a sense of seriousness and dedication to your role in cybersecurity by adhering to a more formal dress code. Remember that your attire is an outward reflection of your professionalism and should be in line with industry standards. It is critical to follow appropriate attire guidelines in any workplace, including the cybersecurity industry. This includes avoiding provocative or revealing clothing, which can cause distractions, discomfort, and convey an unprofessional or disrespectful image. You contribute to a focused and respectful work environment by maintaining a professional image. Dressing appropriately not only promotes a cohesive and professional environment, but it also shows respect for colleagues and organizations. Oh, sorry. Professional behaviors are critical in the cybersecurity industry. For establishing a solid reputation, professionalism entails actively listening to others, being open to feedback, and practicing accountability. You demonstrate respect and foster effective communications within your team by listening attentively and seeking to understand. Taking responsibility for your actions and taking ownership of your work also demonstrates your dedication to excellence. These qualities not only contribute to a positive and collaborative work environment, but they also help to improve your professional image. Professional behaviors are critical in the cybersecurity industry for establishing a solid reputation. Professionalism entails actively listening to others, being open to feedback, and practicing accountability. Respect and foster effective communications within your team by listening attentively and seeking to understand. Taking responsibility for your actions and taking ownership of your work also demonstrates your dedication. These qualities not only contribute to a positive and collaborative work environment, but they also help to improve your professional image. An example of trying to maintain a proper professional image. Tattoos and piercings should be covered or minimalized in the workplace. While personal expressions is encouraged, visible tattoos or excessive piercings can be distracting and may jeopardize professional standards. It is critical to prioritize your appearance so that it does not overshadow your expertise and abilities. You can foster a focused and credible work environment by maintaining a professional image that aligns with industry norms. Let's talk about the importance of balancing self-expression with professional standards in cybersecurity fields. Maintaining professionalism in the cybersecurity field necessitates extreme caution and diligence when dealing with sensitive data. Negligent data handling is not only unprofessional, but it also exposes organizations to significant cybersecurity risks. Negligence can manifest itself in a variety of ways, such as failing to follow established security protocols, leaving confidential data unattended or easily accessible, sharing sensitive information with unauthorized individuals, and failing to use encryption or proper disposal methods. These actions increase the likelihood of data breaches, which can have serious consequences such as reputational damage, financial loss, legal ramifications, and the loss of trust from clients and partners. Unprofessional behavior can seriously undermine an organization's cybersecurity efforts. In particular, poor communication and collaboration can have a negative impact on cybersecurity practices. Inadequate communication among cybersecurity team members impedes the timely identification and response to security threats. Delays in reporting incidents exacerbate mitigation efforts. Furthermore, a lack of knowledge and information sharing limits colleagues' ability to stay informed and make informed decisions. Collaboration with other departments or stakeholders weakens the overall cybersecurity defense. These behaviors result in missed prevention opportunities, longer response times, and weakened teamwork, all of which reduce the organization's cybersecurity resilience. Projecting competence, credibility, and professionalism in the cybersecurity industry extends beyond appearance to Projecting competence, credibility, and professionalism in the cybersecurity industry extends beyond appearance to include attire, behavior, and best practices. Your professional image reflects your commitment to excellence and plays an important role in shaping your industry reputation. By dressing professionally, acting respectfully, and following best practices for appearance, you lay a solid foundation for success. Remember that maintaining a professional image is an ongoing commitment, and upholding high standards consistently contributes to your overall professional brand. Thank you for listening. Here are my references. Sorry, it is a bit rushed, and I'm sorry that I'm stuttering a lot. It is a bit late in the night for me. But yeah, that is all for me. Thank you very much for listening.
Great job. Covered a lot about that. And that's what a lot of people need to know. Especially when we're going out to get those new jobs, right? All right. So let's see.
Also, just so everyone can know, I will be sharing the presentation here, just in case you would like to have a better detailed look at it, because I may not have actually presented it as well as I could have. Thank you. That'd be all from me.
You did a great job. Very good job.
Thank you very much.
Let me see. I'm looking for. There it is. Okay. So to be ready for. Now we are going to see James.
Good evening, all. Welcome to today's masterclass. My name is James Goldtrap. I am a cybersecurity analyst intern at PGIP, and I'll be presenting on security chaos engineering. I selected this proverb because it perfectly encapsulates the essence of resiliency in chaos engineering and cybersecurity. In this presentation, we will start with an overview of chaos engineering, diving into the history and principles for some background, exploring the current cybersecurity landscape to grasp today's challenges, comparing chaos engineering and penetration testing, discussing the connection between system failures and cybersecurity, analyzing a case study, understanding the limitations and risks of these strategies, looking at what the future holds, and wrapping it up by bringing it all together. Think of chaos engineering as getting a vaccine. Just as vaccines give a small dose of a virus to strengthen the body, chaos engineering purposely disrupts a system. The goal is to find and fix weak spots so the system can handle unexpected problems. Instead of waiting for an issue to pop up, we actively test and improve our system in conditions that mirror in the real world. Through chaos engineering, we aim for a never-ending cycle of learning, improving, and making our systems even better. As we discuss this today, remember that chaos engineering is our game plan for making systems more resilient and dependable. Chaos engineering started in Netflix in the early 2010s. As Netflix systems got more complex, they wanted more than just traditional testing. They needed a way to test their systems in the real-world situations. So in 2011, Netflix came up with Chaos Monkey. This tool was a significant change. It purposely created problems in their systems to find weak spots. This was the beginning of chaos engineering. Thanks to the success of Chaos Monkey and other tools in the Simian Army, many other companies began to use chaos engineering. It's a big part of site reliability engineering. Here are six main principles of chaos engineering. Start small. Start with a small test and gradually make them bigger. This way you will avoid accidentally causing big problems. Predict outcomes. Before doing tests, hypothesize what might happen. This will help you understand the test results better. Mimic real life problems. The test should recreate real problems, like if a server stops working or a connection break. Test in real connections. Even though it sounds risky, it's best to test in a real-world setting, but always do this carefully and safely. Automate your test. Keep running tests regularly, even during work hours. This ensures the system is always robust. Learn and get better. The aim isn't just to create problems, but to find weak spots and make systems more robust. In short, Chaos engineering is all about making sure systems are always ready for anything. Cybersecurity is constantly changing because of the cyber threats keep evolving. We face new risks daily, like changing malware and creating creative ways hackers attack. There are many more advanced. There are also more advanced threats, often backed by governments, that spy on us for long periods of time. As we move to newer systems like cloud platforms, we open the doors for hackers. And with more devices connected to the internet, they can attack from many more points. Many big companies and governments have faced major cyber attacks. These attacks have led to massive data loss and substantial financial costs. But the harm isn't just immediate. Companies lose trust, which can hurt them in the long run. Challenges also bring chances to grow. We need to change how we protect ourselves. We still need our old defenses like firewalls, but we need more. Taking a cue from chaos engineering, many experts believe we should actively test our systems by pretending to attack them. Let us see how our defensive works and find weak spots. In the ever-evolving world of cybersecurity, we must continuously learn, adapt, and innovate to stay ahead of threats. This all started with a simple question. How was chaos engineering different than penetration testing? Chaos engineering is all about expecting the unexpected. It checks how resilient or reliable a system is. Imagine you want to see how tough a toy is, so you drop it, step on it, or throw it. Similarly, in chaos engineering, we intentionally cause problems like shutting down critical servers or slowing down the network. This helps us see if a system can keep working and fix itself. The main goal is to find a weak spot in the building, a weak spot within the system, and how different parts work together. Penetration testing, on the other hand, is like a security check. Its main goal is to find gaps that the bad guy might use to get in. This is done by pretending to attack a system, helping us spot security risks. It doesn't just look at software, but also the whole system is set up and how people use it, like with fake scams in emails such as phishing. After testing, we know where the system can be better protected against hackers or data theft. Even though they are different, chaos engineering and penetration testing have much in common. Both want to find and fix problems before they become real issues. They believe in testing things in real life situations and need a deep understanding of the system being tested. While chaos engineering checks if a system can handle and recover from problems, penetration testing ensures it's safe from attacks. Together, they help businesses create robust digital systems ready for today's challenge. When looking at security chaos engineering, I wonder, should a security team worry about system failures? I think some of you are already shaking your head yes to this. So let's dive into why. One of the main pillars of cybersecurity is availability, meaning systems or services should always be accessible. The idea is part of the CIA triad, which stands for confidentiality, integrity, and availability. So if there's a disruption in availability due to a system failure, it's directly affects this crucial cybersecurity concept. But there's more to system failure than just an eruption. They can hide real threats. Regular system hiccups can overwhelm security systems with false alarms, making it hard to spot actual harmful activities. Clever hackers might use the frequent glitches to hide their actions or even cause distractions on purpose. Also, unexpected failures can cause system to act erratically, exposing weak spots. For example, a backup system might not be as secure as the main one. If the primary system breaks and the backups kick in, it might be an easy target for hackers. System failures can also damage or lose data, which threaten another core concept of cybersecurity, data integrity. Trust is critical in our digital world. If a system fails, users will not maintain faith. They might even look for other, less safe ways to get what they need, which can expose them to scans or risks. The steps to handle system failures are often similar in measures for handling security problems. So a cybersecurity team that deals with security failures will also be good at responding to security incidences. Modern systems are complicated and connected. A problem in one area can cause an issue all over. Understanding how these parts depend on each other is essential for keeping things running and spotting hidden security threats. In emergencies, teams might need to use particular tools or methods to fix things quickly. If there are tools, please remind yourself that these tools still need to appropriately be checked by security, or they could offer a risk or a new vector of attack for threat actors. So even if a hacker doesn't always cause system failures, they can still significantly affect cybersecurity. Cybersecurity teams should work closely with IT teams to avoid and handle these problems when they arise. There are a growing need to defend against online physical threats in an ever-changing cybersecurity landscape. Cardinal Health faced this exact challenge. John Hartman led the way with his vast experience as an FBI agent specializing in information protection. Heading a team of 15 experts, they aimed to protect both digital and physical assets. What made their approach stand out was combining digital and physical security measures. They focused on being proactive, working together, and guiding others. Hartman's team believed in education. Instead of just setting rules, they taught business owners the importance of their assets and the risks they face. The idea was simple. If people understand the value in threats, they will also follow security measures. They also emphasize working closely with departments to get complete pictures of potential risks. At the same time, running mock events for a wide array of events, both digitally and within the physical facility. Ultimately, Cardinal Health transformed its cybersecurity approach into a flexible, innovative model that can tackle a wide range of risks. When diving into security chaos engineering, I want to address its challenges and considerations. First, there's a need for balance. While we aim to mimic real-life threats to test our defenses, there's a risk of causing real damage or showing our vulnerabilities to outsiders. This means we must be careful not to overdo our tests, or we might give a roadmap to real attackers, or even disrupt our systems. This includes not disseminating information about the tests to people who don't need to know. Next is the debate between testing in live environments, production. Versus controlled setting, sandbox. Testing in a live environment has risks like causing disruption. However, testing in controlled settings might not show us how our systems behave in the real world conditions, which could lead to a false sense of security. We also have to consider ethics. Simulating cyber threats can come close to real hacking, especially involving people unaware of the test. We must ensure we don't violate privacy rules or agreements or unintentionally harm someone. Then it is crucial to set limits. Like an artist needs a canvas, we need a clear guideline and goal for our chaos experiments to avoid unintended consequences that could harm trust or even legal matters. However, even when our tests succeed, we might still develop a false sense of security. We might think we're safe and miss other vulnerabilities. Therefore, we should always change and expand our tests. We must remember that one test won't protect us from every threat. Chaos engineering can help us see where we are vulnerable, but it also has risks. It is crucial to approach with care. Now that we understand the basics of chaos engineering in cybersecurity, let's look at an exciting future of possibilities. First, considering the use of advanced technology. Think about using machine learning and AI as both tools and partners. They could help predict systems will act under stress and improve our tests. With the rise of quantum computing, which has security challenges, chaos engineering might need to evolve to test networks with apps built within this new technology. Next, there's potential for better testing environments. Using cloud technology, we can make a more flexible and realistic test environments. These sandboxes would be almost identical to our production system. We could even run tests alongside our regular operations with more powerful computers. We should also think more extensively about the tests. What if something physical, like a power failure, affects our digital system? As everything gets more connected, we must see how people react during these tests. How do they behave during a cyber incident? There are also new areas to explore. We might soon be able to predict where a system might fail by looking at past data. And as our world becomes even more connected, we could test how cyber incidences affects not just an organization, but many at once. All in all, the future of chaos engineering and cybersecurity is full of potential. Combining it with the latest technology can help us make safe, ethical, and reliable systems. Thinking about chaos engineering and cybersecurity, I was reminded of a Japanese saying, the same saying that I mentioned at the beginning of this presentation. Fall 7 times, stand up 8. It speaks to the heart of resilience, the core of cyber or security chaos engineering. Whether we find and fix a weakness, our systems become more robust. Combining chaos engineering with cybersecurity gives companies a straightforward way to examine system resilience and protect against threats. Given our complicated digital world, this combination isn't just good to have, it's essential. It's also crucial to be proactive, fixing problems before something goes wrong. By running a chaos test, we can get ahead of problems, staying true to the idea of getting back up each time and becoming stronger. Lastly, I encourage everyone to learn about the idea behind security chaos engineering. As we depend more on digital systems, the stakes get higher. It's not just about avoiding problems, but building trust and long-term strength. So, with security chaos engineering, we see a future where we can keep moving forward no matter what comes our way. Thank you.
That was a great presentation. That was a good recording. Yeah, it was a good recording. You did really, really good. So, James, when you see this, excellent job. Good information. I love the chaos theory that you added to that. Very good implementation of all that information. Awesome. And I want to thank everybody for some great presentations. You all did a great job. Thank you for joining the masterclass this evening. I know it was a long one, and they will be long because now we have more students who do master classes, and the more students we get, the more we're going to have to figure this out. We might have to have a whole day session of master classes. Probably not. But I thank everybody for joining and watching the presentations, being part of your classmates as we go through this, and definitely add these recordings and these presentations to your portfolios. I'm telling you, you'll get jobs for them. Because of those, you will get jobs. It's always very impressive. So other than that, have a great evening. Thank you for joining, and I will see you for the next one.